Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. There are those who are veteran listeners to this program who seem to perceive that the host of this program has grown somehow more conservative over the years. Actually, they're not totally wrong. And one of the people who's helped me in that direction is my guest tonight. That is to say, when I read his stuff, I thump the table and say, by God, that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. That's Harry Stein, who is, among many other things these days, he is a veteran journalist, and in more recent years, he's been a leading person at, I think, one of the best journals in the country, that being the magazine produced by the Manhattan Institute, and it we'll say more about it as we continue. But he's also the author, a while ago, of a book titled What was the exact title, Harry?
How I Accidentally Joined the Vast Right-Wing Conspiracy and Found Inner Peace.
Yes, but inner peace didn't prevent you from going on with still considerable inner agitation to write the new book titled I Can't Believe I'm Sitting Next to a Republican, and subtitle, A Survival Guide for Conservatives Marooned Among the Angry, Smug, and Terminally Self-Righteous. So I hereby tell all of our liberal listeners they're going to be a bit aroused, if not annoyed, but we're eager to talk with them once they call in during the second hour, and all conservatives are welcome as well, as we examine the transformation of American public life and institutional life into a kind of pervasive demand structure in which certain kinds of people, including Harry Stein, maybe even Milt Rosenberg, are sometimes a bit inhibited about speaking their true mind. We'll get into all of that as we follow the adventures and misadventures of Harry Stein in that stronghold of liberalism, New York, as we continue right after the update on this evening's news. My guest tonight, Harry Stein, is, as I was indicating before in my rather breathless pre-introduction, a former liberal, one would say, in the conventional American political jargon, who is now certainly a present conservative. Or would you rather use other terms to designate what you are and what you've become?
I'm comfortable with conservative, although I often put a slash on it and make myself a conservative libertarian. I actually voted libertarian in 2004.
But you were once a, quote, liberal, or is liberal not really the properly descriptive term?
I was the left of a conventional liberal. I was a serious left-winger. I came from a very left-wing family, and my parents had I was a red diaper baby. My parents had been.
That means your parents were actual members of the Communist Party.
Members of the Communist Party, and very idealistic kids in the 30s. You know, came out of poor Bronx Jewish homes, and they and everyone in their circle, I gather, were serious radicals, and. By the time I came along, they were no longer communists. They were Democrats. I guess they were Henry Wallace Democrats or progressives in 48, and they loved Stevenson. So my earliest awareness of politics was that Stevenson was a wonderful human being and Eisenhower was a moron. And that's basically what I grew up with. And then they were enamored of Kennedy, of course, in 60, and it went on from there.
The basic line with regard to presidents you don't like if you're on the left, maybe the same would work if you're on the right and you got a left-wing president, but the basic line about conservative or apparently conservative presidents from the point of view of the left is that they're stupid.
Right.
That's certainly what they said about George W. Bush.
The only one they didn't say it about, really, was Nixon. And they had all kinds of other reasons to despise Nixon.
They said it about Reagan. He was probably senile already, was the line they used regularly.
Right, right. You know, it's very dismissive. It bleeds over into their view of conservatives in general. They don't think we're very bright. I have something in the book, actually, this latest book, about psychological studies.
I know one of those guys.
Oh, really?
That group out in California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And were they proved that we're stupid?
Not only stupid, but otherwise deranged and very rigid of character, very intolerant of ambiguity, et cetera, et cetera.
Stupid is the least.
All the jargon.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But anyway, in terms of my own transition, I was in college in the 60s. I went to Pomona College, which is a small school in Southern California. When I began at Pomona in the fall of 66, it was a rather conservative place. I was one of those who radicalized it very quickly. By the time I graduated, you know, we had the same strikes as everyone else in the spring of 1970 and took over various buildings. I was in the middle of all of that, published a radical paper in college. As a matter of fact, one of my schoolmates was Bill Keller, currently the mm-hmm. executive editor of the New York Times. And
he hasn't turned quite as conservative as you have.
He has not. Although Bill is more conservative than he lets on. When he was merely a columnist at the Times, he was, by New York Times standards, extremely reasonable. Now that he's editor, of course, all of that's disappeared.
Well, you've got all the credentials for a former lefty who's now certainly an anti-lefty or certainly a conservative.
Right.
How does one account for the kind of change that occurred for and with you and occurred in the lives of many other people we could name who are now rather prominent conservatives? One person who came to my mind as you were describing your life history is David Horowitz.
Yes.
Who kind of went through the same sequence, he's about 10 years older than you, I think.
He's exactly 10 years older. He just turned 70. I just turned 60. I appeared at one of David's retreats, his annual retreats, mm-hmm. and when my book came out, and I described it as Radical Sunlight, because it's very...
Title of his book, yeah.
His book was Radical Sun. It's very nearly the same transition, except he was always more radical, and I think my book is funnier, but the...
He's angrier. You've remained somewhat amused.
Yes. I mean, in self-protection, I think it's good for conservatives, particularly those of us who try to survive in liberal milieus, to keep a healthy sense of humor.
Now, if you had been conservative at the time that you were, in fact, a left-winger, would you have been subject to as much abuse, as much condescension, as much rejection as you have been once you made your shift?
That's a very good question. You know, I remember when I was in college, there were kids, a handful of kids, who were very conservative and really held to their principles.
They favored the Vietnam War.
They
espoused patriotism and so on.
There was a guy, I remember, who was in my dorm who was in ROTC, and he was, a very strong conservative. And people kind of taunted him about it, but in a good-natured way. I mean, we're not talking... Pomona was not it was not Berkeley. There was not the kind of viciousness I think you found at some really more serious left-wing places.
So it turned more vicious in time.
Yes, but in any case, I was thinking about him because I looked him up at a reunion a few years ago and told him how much I respected him and for having stood up for those principles. And he told me what it was like, how hard it was for him, how lonely he felt. You know, and those people clung together for protection, even at a place like Pomona. Another thing, he didn't get very many girls. I mean, I'm very grateful that I became a conservative after I'd sown a lot of wild oats. It would have been a terrible, terrible thing to have been a conservative, particularly in those years, 60s and 70s, have to try to deal with that in romantic relationships.
Two questions necessarily present themselves. One is, what happened to you? What actually set you to doubt what was your built-in, profoundly based convictions, inherited, so to speak, socially inherited from your parents and from the large milieu around you? What accounts for the change? Similarly, what accounts for the change in this country that our left-right division, which has always been there, has grown more vituperative, less marginally tolerant, and really more problematic and more scary for what it says about how we live now and what's going to happen to us? I shall persist with those two questions right after we do what we can to buoy up capitalism with these words. My guest tonight is Harry Stein, who's been here before, and is the author now of the brand-new book, I Can't Believe I'm Sitting Next to a Republican. That was actually said to you at a dinner party, wasn't it?
It was, exactly. I was searching for a title. I'd considered the title Red Manhattan, the reference being to red state types who are in Manhattan. And, of course, there are plenty of real Reds in Manhattan, or former Reds, and so it was very confusing to a lot of people. So I was searching for a title. I was at a dinner party in my little town of Hastings-on-Hudson, just north of the city, which is a very left-leaning town. And it was early on during the Obama-Hillary slugfest. And, of course, everyone at the dinner party was singing Obama's praises and these hosannas to Obama. And I very tentatively raised or in a very mild way, I should say, raised the question of Obama's inexperience. And this guy beside me, whom I'd known all of 10 minutes at this point, turned to me and with a look as if I was wearing a hood and a Nazi armband. And he snarled, "I can't believe I'm sitting next to a Republican." Inaccurate, by the way. I'm not registered as a Republican. And so, you know, the lousy dinner party at least got me a title.
A good title, I would say. Because the subtitle, after "I can't believe I'm sitting next to a Republican," is a survival guide for conservatives marooned among the angry, smug, and terminally self-righteous. That's kind of hard on the liberals. Not all of them are necessarily angry, smug, and terminally self-righteous, are
they?
That's
true. I probably wrote that on a bad day.
a few of my remaining best friends, in fact, are liberal.
You know, part of my thinking was, you know, the previous book, How I Accidentally Joined the Vast Right-Wing Conspiracy, I actually believed would generate a dialogue with liberals. Having moved over from the left myself, I thought, you know, some people would be interested in why someone who was as rigidly to the left as I had been would make such a transition. But in fact, I don't think a single liberal read it, including members of my family. And this time I was pretty certain going in that this was a book that liberals would not care to read. It was for people who had lived this experience, a great many people I know who have been in exactly the situation I'm in. And it would give them aid, comfort, and maybe stiffen their spines a little bit.
Well, let me go then back to the question. I've raised two questions before. One, how do you account for the change that you went through? And two, how do you account for the change in the country, which has made the change that you went through more of a burden and more of a difficulty than otherwise would have been the case?
Well, to the first question, it was very much a matter in my case, as it is in most people's, of their specific life circumstances. I was doing a column for Esquire magazine in the late 70s and early 80s called Ethics. And it was a tough column to write. I had to think about things I hadn't really thought about much before. Also, I had to make it funny and entertaining, which was the real difficult part. And I began writing a lot about our generation, those of us who'd come of age in the 60s, looking back at particularly at our seemingly bottomless capacity for self-justification. So that began my thinking about some of these issues. It was during this time that I met my wife and married, and we had our first child. She was born in May of 1981. My wife was the story editor for Columbia Pictures in New York City at the time, which was a prestigious-sounding job anyway. It didn't actually do all that much. But she decided in the hospital that she did not want to go back to work and she was going to stay home with our child, which in our circle, which was primarily people in media, was absolutely unheard of. This was considered a betrayal of the feminist ethic at the time. And she became kind of persona non grata among a lot of her friends.
Were already living in Hastings-on-Hudson?
No, at that point we were still living in the city, on the Upper West Side.
In Manhattan, yeah.
Yeah. And so she was very conscious of this and very hurt by it. But our daughter seemed to be thriving. A year or so later, I was asked by Esquire if I was interested in doing a piece for their special women's issue. And I said I'd really like to take a look at daycare and see if it's really best for the child. And I did what was a fairly objective reported piece. I spoke to people on both sides of the issue. I spent a lot of time at daycare centers. Among the people I interviewed was Dr. Spock, who I'd spoken to previously for another piece. And Spock said something which should have been a tip-off about how dangerous this was. He said, you know, I have real problems with daycare, but that is off the record.
Uh-huh.
Lee Salk, the eminent child psychologist, did go on the record and said something which is really quite extraordinary. He said, and I think this is an exact quote, "I love dogs, but I'd never have a large dog in a New York City apartment because I don't think it's fair to the dog. I think women who can afford to stay home with their children and choose not to should consider not having children or delaying having children."
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the piece appeared, and instead of generating the lively conversation on this vital issue that I expected, I got a torrent of abuse, a tidal wave, unlike anything I'd ever experienced. I mean, I'd never experienced any...
Just for raising the question of whether early nursing child care might not be the best idea.
Right. You know, I was a woman hater, a sexist. I was a vicious, whatever. You know all the epithets. And that was an eye opener. It was really my first inkling of understanding that there were certain issues where there was a party line, and you could not deviate from it. Of course, there are a fair number of issues like that. So it was a slow progression. But another key moment for me was. 1985, shortly after the Reagan-Mondale election, I proposed a piece to the Times magazine on why we liberals, as I then continued to think of myself, had surrendered the values issues to the right.
Meaning what by values issues?
Issues of basic morality. I mean, everything from... you know, what was important in life, talk of family, talk of the needs of, rather than simply the material needs of children.
And probably also uncertainty about abortion.
Abortion was certainly one of the issues that I dealt with.
Yeah.
And the form of the piece, mm-hmm. Well, there were two things that really had an impact on me. One, I spoke to a lot of people on the left, people who considered themselves liberals, but who had deviated on one specific issue, whether it was affirmative action, whether it was abortion. In fact, I spoke to Nat Hentoff about abortion, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was daycare, I spoke to James Fallows' wife, Debbie Fallows, who'd written a book about it. There were four or five such issues. And the other thing that, and all of them felt very alienated from the left, and in some cases from the Democratic Party, for having dared to take such a stand.
What you began to run into was that there was a tradition of absolutely rigid received doctrine
that
people who were sort of active, intelligent liberals.
Right, right. I would say not active or intelligent liberals.
Or reflexive liberals.
Yeah, reflexive.
A range of open discussion, examining and trying to sift and winnow the facts and the principles to which the facts should be related, that was no longer possible.
Right, right. Exactly right. Also during this piece, I went down to Washington, spent a fair amount of time with some of the Reagan people.
Uh-huh.
And that was probably more influential than anything else, because I found these people, I'd always regarded these people as monsters.
Mm-hmm.
I'd accepted that they were, if not, I was going to say subhuman, obviously they weren't that, but they were hard-hearted, nasty SOBs as far as I was concerned. And meeting them, I found them not only very reasonable human beings, but extremely thoughtful, and more thoughtful on a lot of these issues than the people in my circle. My wife put it to me. She had been a member of a women's group called Women Against Right Wing Scum. She said 3 years later she was right wing scum.
Hmm. It's an interesting transition. To personalize just a bit as well. Mm-hmm. I did not vote for Reagan on his first run. I voted against him, and thought him probably a fool, and was very worried about how all the big guys were leaguing together to put this mere actor forward, and he was going to not intelligent enough to see how he was being manipulated. Gary Wills of this very community up in Evanston did a book, an anti-Reagan book, shortly after Reagan was elected, I guess, sat in this very studio, and we chatted about it, and I thought, by golly, Wills is right. This is definitive. But the more I watched what was happening, and the more I watched the reaction to Reagan, I think that was really the beginning of my transition. Though another thing that was really very active for me goes way back to the Vietnam War. I was actively against the Vietnam War. I was a member of the National Board of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, whose chairman at that time was Ben Spock. And Yet I wrote a book which was essentially anti-Vietnam War. Wrote it together with another guy, a distinguished political scientist, Sidney Verba. But in the years, it was published in 72. McGovern wrote the introduction to the book. But in the years following, when I saw how the world was going and recognized the force of the Soviet threat and the rising power of China, I began to reconsider and express that to some of my friends, which amazed and absolutely offended most of them. When I said, maybe I was wrong about the Vietnam War. Maybe we were wrong about it. That was the beginning of my shift. Once you begin to question the liberal left-wing orthodoxy, once you begin to question it, it all dissolves rather quickly, I think.
That's why so many people cannot question any of it at all.
Yeah.
Because those questions are dangerous.
We are due to pause for an update on the news. Then directly back, the question left over, we've talked about how you changed. How has the country changed and why? And where are we now in terms of intolerance for proper democratic exchange of views and proper debate, if necessary? Why don't we respect the other side, as once we were capable of doing? Our guest, Harry Stein, who is a contributing editor at City Journal, the journal of the Manhattan Institute, the fully is the Manhattan Institute for public policy. So it's just called the Manhattan Institute.
Right.
It's a great organization. And Harry Stein's new book is titled "I Can't Believe I'm Sitting Next to a Republican: A Survival Guide for Conservatives Marooned Among the Angry, Smug, and Terminally Self-Righteous." And the question is, are they that? And if so, how did they become angry, smug, and terminally self-righteous? I've posed that question to you. How did that national change occur? If it did occur, I want to read you something that's just come in by email.
Okay.
Because it poses the same question much more directly and in direct human terms. This fellow says, "Hello, Milt. I was raised in a blue-collar Democratic family. We were Harry Truman Democrats. As years went by, in my 30s, I became a Republican. My sister, however, is a rabid Democrat to the extent that she spews hateful and acrid comments about me to the rest of the family. While I am a college grad and she only a high school grad, she calls me, quote, stupid and ignorant. She is just plain mean. I see this as a common denominator amongst many of today's Democrats. What has brought this acrimony to the surface in our country?"
Okay, I should interject. Encounter is starting a website called BlueStateResistance.com, in which we're welcoming people to tell their own stories. So if you have one to tell, feel free. You know, when you first posed that question, I was thinking about it. I recall in the 60s that we were as vicious as on the left as anyone is today.
But you were a mere agitated, rabidly left college kid,
and that's I think what we're getting to. The left was angry during that period. Was certainly furious at Nixon. It was ugly during that period. It was ugly during the Reagan period. The Clinton period was ugly on both sides. They were certainly very angry during the Bush period. Maybe angrier than ever. I think what's happened is that people like us, who were kids in the '60s, who called people fascists reflexively, and used all that kind of terminology, essentially moved into the mainstream and took over the mainstream. There was in the 60s, there were a lot of responsible liberals who kind of dictated the terms of public discourse. Now it is people of my generation who came of age in the 60s who are the gatekeepers or should be the gatekeepers and simply are not. I mean, you look at the New York Times op-ed page, for example. You know, you always had liberals on the New York Times op-ed page, but you had people like Scottie Reston, who were reasonable and restrained, certainly left of center in their politics, or certainly very liberal. Now you have Paul Krugman, who refers to people on the other side as haters and traitors and...
And I'll give you somebody else. You indicated to me earlier in a private conversation that he was once a close friend of yours, Frank Rich.
Yep, Frank is...
Absolutely vicious and violent in his commentary.
Yes. Well, you know, Frank, I met in 1962 at summer camp, and we were close friends. I was best man at his first wedding.
Really?
We were very close friends.
And he was another radical kid, was he?
Frank always went with what was the strongest political... If the New York Times moved to the right, I think Frank would move to the right with them. That's my Frank feeling about Frank Rich. But anyway, he is He is quite appalling, as a lot of them are. I mean, I did a piece for City Journal a few years ago about a guy named Charles Pickering, who had been appointed by George Bush to the appeals court, a Mississippi judge who during the civil rights era had been quite heroic. He had been a district attorney in the small town of Laurel, Mississippi, and had taken on the KKK at enormous personal, professional, and obviously physical risk
sure.
to himself, testified against the most violent KKK leader in Mississippi. Subsequently, as a district court judge, presided over a cross-burning case, very complicated case, but he ended up giving one of the defendants less time than he could have, because there were extenuating circumstances. Excuse me. The special interests which were driving the fight against Charles Pickering accused him of being soft on cross burners, and a number of New York Times columnists, including Krugman and Frank and others, accused him of being, just picked up that theme. It was the most vicious thing I've ever seen. I mean, these people really have no scruples when it comes to demonizing people on the right.
It's just as people, is it comparable to the way some on the right in the so-called McCarthy era demonized people on the left?
Very much so. Very much so. That said, there are certainly people on the right who do the same thing to people on the left.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these this ugly terminology is thrown around promiscuously.
I think that's a crucial term, then, demonization. The practice of demonization has become quite standard in American political discourse, it was only to be found at the far extremes.
Right. Or primarily on the right. I think it's now primarily on the left.
And in this book of yours, you look into a number of institutional areas. One that interests me a great deal, because I've been involved in it all my life, is education. You've got some very good chapters on university lefties and what they've done to the curriculum, what they've done to the quality of university life. But this also extends down into the public schools, the elementary and certainly the high schools.
Oh, absolutely. At this point, it's K through graduate level.
What happens on K through graduate level?
Well, as one woman said to me about her very small child, about the teaching of American history, they start off with the oppression of the Indians and they skip immediately to the oppression of the slaves. They skip over the founding fathers, the American Revolution, anything that might reflect well on the history of America and the uniqueness of the American experience.
I told you earlier that my son and daughter-in-law and my son's parents, namely I and my wife, were really quite disturbed to find that in the new school that our grandson, Max, entered when he finished whatever grade it was. He's now 12. What grade does that put
Maybe
him in?
Sixth, probably.
Yeah.
Sixth,
as he entered
fifth or sixth.
As he entered the seventh grade in a middle school in a western city, his social studies class had only one text, and it was Howard Zinn's People's History of America. And the teacher referred to it constantly and resonated to it in total agreement. Explain what one finds in that volume of Howard Zinn's, which has earned Zinn millions and millions.
I mean, basically, the United States is an oppressor nation. The United States exists essentially to oppress third world peoples and its own indigenous Indian population.
And all in the name of capitalism, of course,
which is
intrinsically a great evil.
Exactly. I mean, it is a standard leftist text, and that this is being foisted upon small children. You know, thinking back on my own childhood, and maybe this is why I and my wife and many people of our generation, although we were hard left at a certain point in our lives, moved to the right later on. In the wake of World War II, there was enormous pride in America.
Mm-hmm.
Our fathers had fought that war. They had won that war. I mean, it was long before anyone talked about the Greatest Generation.
So that even on the left, one felt rather patriotically American.
Yes. I mean, I remember during the Vietnam period, what we felt above a sense of disappointment in our country and maybe a betrayal of certain ideals with which we had come of age. And that was certainly, for a lot of us, I think, the motivating factor. We acted out very childishly and very stupidly in many respects. But I think for a lot of us, it was motivated by a real disappointment. But we never really fundamentally lost that love of country. I think that's changed in the left. I think the left is almost uniformly condemnatory of America, looks for fault, and defines that as patriotism.
You know, I've in a way misled our listeners up to this point. The discourse we've been having has been serious, solemn. I think it's on very important stuff, and you have illuminated a great deal very effectively. But this doesn't give the full nature and texture of your new book. I Can't Believe I'm Sitting to a Republican, which is, among other things, a very funny book.
Well, thank you.
And we need to come to some of your adventures and misadventures as recounted in this book, and we'll do that right after we pause for this. And directly back to Harry Stein. I was inviting you, Harry. Let's get some of the great stories in your book.
Well, I have a chapter about family and mm-hmm. you know, these terrible rifts that develop in families. I talk at some length about the situation in my own family with my father, of course, who remains very left-wing. This is my father in a nutshell. He's quite elderly now. A couple of years ago, he was en route somewhere with my stepmother and began feeling ill. So they called their destination, and when they got there, there were some EMT people waiting. And the head EMT guy said, how do you feel? He said, I don't feel so good. He said, what hurts you? He said, it hurts me that George Bush is president.
Yeah.
That's my father. It's always at the tip of his tongue. So and I go on to explain, you know, the problems that we had in communicating over a couple of years over politics and how we've managed to a certain extent to put that aside.
Daily life in Hastings on Hudson. You and your wife have to assume a certain disguise at times, don't you?
It's not much of a disguise at this point since
anymore.
I wrote a book. Yeah. My wife got away with it for a while. People felt sorry for her being married to me until one day she was exposed in, of all places, the New York Times. It was around the time of Hurricane Katrina. And the Times every day was running horror stories about how the Bush administration had failed and fallen down the job.
They had virtually ordered the hurricane, in fact.
Ordered the hurricane, ordered the shooting of looters, and ordered the death. And she was quoted to the effect that if more looters were shot, the New York Times would say no. That Bush's critics would go in saying that he had gone in guns blazing. What she had actually said was, "You at the New York Times would say that he had gone in with Bush." But in any case, our friends were shocked to see her on the front page, seeming to support George Bush, which was worse than anything that I had ever done publicly, as far as they were concerned. So my wife couldn't get away with it. My wife has really far more outspoken than I am, and she's kind of a lunatic with her politics. And there was a story, I actually don't tell this in the book, but it was a very unfortunate occasion. It was the election night 2000, when we were watching the returns with one of our very few conservative friends in our little town, and Florida had already been called for Gore, and she was disconsolate.
Because that would have meant Gore as the next president.
That would have meant Gore was president. This was early on in the evening.
Sure.
And at which point our friend's wife appeared. She was a lovely woman, an elderly nursery school teacher, the sweetest woman in the world. And my wife stares at the TV and she mutters, I can't believe anyone voted for Al Gore. And this very lovely woman says, well, I did. And there was about a half-second pause. My wife said, it's the women, the stupid, stupid women. It was such a horrifying moment. And I said, maybe we should go home. And we left and we...
But that's just about as intolerant as you...
You're right.
The left is.
My wife was intolerant as a leftist.
Yeah.
And she's pretty intolerant as a rightist. I make no excuses for her. Thank God she's not here.
Less intolerant? Are you more accepting of your liberal friends?
Yes, to the extent they're capable of civil conversation. I mean, those who are. Mm. I've made actually one quite good friend recently, a fellow writer. We met about a project, and we ended up talking about politics. And he's very open-minded, and we have terrific conversations. He says he agrees with everything I say, only from the opposite perspective.
Yeah. That's sort of the way life used to be, it seems to me.
I think there was certainly a lot more of that. As I say, I mean, when I was on the left, I tended to speak only to people on the left. Now that I'm on the right, I speak to people on both sides. So I'm much more, I think I've grown much more open-minded.
Mm-hmm. For me, I think another thing that began to shift me a bit before I made a real shift was contact with the military. Mm. I did a lot of work for a while on strategic policy issues from the intellectoid standpoint, and wrote mm-hmm. some stuff on that. And then I, rather early in my professional career, I wound up for just a brief stint at the Naval War College doing a special project. Had nothing to do really with strategy, nothing to do with arms. It had to do with pedagogy within the military setting. But these were such impressive, interesting people and such intelligent people, quite... I got there because of the research I'd been doing as a graduate student at the University of Michigan. This was shortly after I'd finished my degree. It doesn't matter what it was, because it has nothing to do with the real content of military life. But I was there with these people, living in the bachelor officers' quarters for a while during one summer. And I was just absolutely delighted with these guys. Simply didn't look like what – they didn't fit my stereotype of military
right,
men.
Right. Well, people on the left tend to have very, very little contact with the military. My my father-in-law worked at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey,
uh-huh.
taught there.
Yeah.
And so all of his friends were ex-military. And I agree. I mean, the exposure to people like that is really a marvelous eye-opener. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking when you were talking about Barbara Boxer the other day, questioning the general.
Yes, that silly scene.
That ridiculous scene.
Where he wouldn't let him call her ma'am.
Which is a term of respect.
Of course it is.
And she.
You call Lady Admirals ma'am.
Exactly.
Yes.
And this, for want of a better term, idiot.
Yeah.
You know, corrected him in a very high-handed way, as if she had been insulted by this terminology. You know, and my wife said that. We were driving in the car. And she said, doesn't he understand this is the way people in the military address women for whom they have respect, including high-ranking officers? But she didn't know that. A United States senator sitting on the Armed Services Committee is unaware of this. I mean, I was going to say shocking, but it's not shocking.
One has to conjecture whether it's, and there's no way of proving it, that there's a bit of a general anti-military attitude colored her taking offense at being called ma'am.
No question. I mean, that was implicit in her tone.
Yeah. You have a good deal to say about American education in there.
I do.
Sing me the song about universities and what happens in the humanities departments, at least, and in the social science departments.
Oh, boy. These departments are dominated by people on the left, and they only hire like-minded people.
That is the sad truth, I think.
Yeah, I talked to a guy who can't remember his name off the top of my head, but who was a Harvard grad, has his doctorate, has written a book. He's in his late 20s. Obviously, quite brilliant.
You got a chapter on him in the book.
Yeah, he's yeah. prominently mentioned. Who has applied to between 300 and 400 jobs has not been. He said, you know, they're hiring all these people who are clearly less qualified than I am. He said, I knew it would be difficult, but I figured I might get, I would surely be hired as a token. And he hasn't been. He basically has no career in academia. I spoke to, now he's the young generation. Someone else I spoke to, an old friend of mine named Gary Apgar.
Yeah.
Who was an art historian, Yale PhD. Also could not get hired.
That's the chapter in your book that I was remembering.
Right.
Yeah.
And Gary, he teaches French now. He had studied. I met him over in Paris. He was a Vietnam vet. I met him in Paris when he was studying at the Sorbonne on the GI Bill. Mm. And he went on to get his PhD, as I say, at Yale.
What have they done to the curriculum in such departments?
Well, they've basically gutted it. You know, the English Lit, for example, I mean, it's all...
Shakespeare's gone and...
Shakespeare, excuse me.
In substitution, we have what?
Oh, we have, you know, whoever the hip, you know, gay or feminist or minority author of the day is, you know, it's all... going back to art history, my friend said one of his problems, besides the fact that he was conservative, was that he was very traditionalist in his approach, and he was very concerned with 18th century French painting. He said, and it was very hard to get a gay critique of 18th century French painting. If he'd been able to give it that twist, he might have had a chance.
To do a gay critique sort of puts you one up. It's,
absolutely.
It's a fashionable thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's cutting edge. This is the kind of scholarship they're looking for.
Uh-huh. Which means you hire a lot of gay people.
Oh, yes, yes. And he was talking about the various little groups within the department. You know, the gay clique and the feminist clique might form a coalition. But there is no conservative clique, and there's no white.
There is usually a Marxist or a post-Marxist clique as well, I think.
Absolutely. I've talked to Ron Radosh, who you probably know.
I know Ron, yeah.
And Ron's, of course.
Yeah. We have to say more about all of this, and we shall, but we're going to pause in just a moment, get an update on the news, and also it's time to invite telephone calls and email. The lines are now open, 591-7200. 312, the area code, then 591-7200. We expect some argument and disagreement tonight, and that's perfectly welcome. Though you might try to put it in a moderate or at least in calm statement rather than hysterical accusation. But if you're in the mood to be hysterically accusatory, I guess we can process that as well. You can be liberal, you can be conservative, you can be apolitical. We'd love to hear from you. 591-7200 for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at tribune, tribune.com, or the aforesaid 591-7200, and we'll return directly to conversation with Harry Stein in a little while onto your contributions, and directly back to Harry Stein, author of the new book, I Can't Believe I'm Sitting Next to a Republican. How do you handle the dilemma of being secretly at least a conservative and being 21 years old or thereabouts and finding lots of attractive women around who are liberals?
It's a terrible problem for a lot of these people. As I say, I'm very glad that when I was that age, I was on the left. The one guy I spoke to, actually here in Chicago, said that he was dating a woman and, you know, they'd gotten to the point after three or four dates when she was went over to his house. He was a big George Bush supporter. In fact, I believe was a precinct captain for him. He said she walks into his house. She sees a portrait of George Bush on his wall. And she turns to him in horror and he says, I don't know who that man is, and I don't know how that got here. You know, there are all kinds of... Actually, a similar story, a guy I know in Los Angeles who is a writer's agent, insisted, he's a Jewish guy, that I give him a name that was so far from his own that no one could ever possibly connect him. So I called him Pablo Garbozo in the book. And he tells me, I asked him if people in the business were aware of his politics. He said, are you kidding? During the primary campaign last year, I had a big Hillary sign on my door and a gigantic Obama sign on my roof facing the studios. Now, he was kind of, I guess he was kidding, but basically that's the attitude there. I mean, people, sort of livelihoods are at stake.
Many years ago, way back in the 1930s probably, Richard Schenck and Dan Katz, two early social psychologists, wrote a paper and then elaborated this in a book about what they called pluralistic ignorance. It was their discovery in a small town in upper New York State that it was a teetotal town, they thought, and a very religious one, but they discovered by private interviews with various people that just about everybody drank secretly. But would then say, offer you a drink down in the basement, would say, don't tell anybody that you had this here, because the rest of them are all absolutely rigid teetotal, and it would make real trouble for me.
Right.
They were all ignorant of the fact that they all drank, or most of them did.
The difference is that if people knew, there would be real trouble for these people.
But is it the case in Hollywood, as in fact, David Horowitz has contended, and he said that a number of times, that there are lots of secret conservatives?
I believe there are, and I spoke.
He's trying to bring them out.
I spoke to a few, exactly. I mean, it's one of the things I'm trying to do with this book, too, give conservatives some spine, particularly at this moment in history. I think it's very important that people have the character to stand up and argue their opinions honestly.
What do you mean by this moment in history? Is there something happening?
I mean, I think it's a very dangerous time for conservatives. I think we're very much under assault. I think there's an effort to label us as certainly as haters, and even as traitorous, that criticism is being characterized as racist in some quarters.
That's the extra burden that's carried now. If you criticize a president who is African American, they can turn against you and say you're being racist.
Absolutely, it started during the campaign. Was very much an issue in the campaign, and frankly, it's the worst label one can have affixed to.
Even worse than homophobe, is it?
Oh, it's far worse. I recount in the book an episode where I was accused of being a racist publicly, and it was absolutely horrifying. It really does shut you up.
The speech in which you quoted the dialogue between Huck and Jim in Huckleberry Finn.
Exactly, and it's actually a little more complicated than that. I told a story about my son, whose 10th grade teacher had characterized Huck Finn as a racist book that she had to teach against her will, and my son countered that it was actually an anti-racist book, and they had got into a...
The issue there is that Mark Twain uses what we now call the N-word.
Exactly. And, you know, she got very testy and accused him of being racially insensitive. It was early on in the term. My son's a very indifferent student anyway. So he came home from school that day and said, well, I'm starting off with a C in that class and working down from there. Alas, all too true. But so I was giving a speech in Dallas, Texas, and I told about this episode and mentioned how proud I was of my son. And afterwards, a black guy in the audience stood up and said he was very offended by my having told that story and regarded it as racist, clearly expected me to apologize, which I was not inclined to do. And I said something along the lines of, you know, I'm sure you're not used to hearing this kind of argument, conservative argument. But, you know, if you're interested in hearing more from black conservatives, maybe you ought to read Shelby Steele or Tom Sowell or John McWhorter. And I got back to New York. I got a call from a representative of the organization saying that I should expect a call from a reporter from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, who had been told that this conservative author had given a racist speech, an inflammatory racist speech. And, excuse me, I preempted that. I called the guy myself and gave him the context, and I could hear he was disappointed. He kind of liked the idea that he had got this conservative racist, and he said, well, you know, I'll ask a few more questions. I promise you I'll ask around. I won't publish anything until I talk to you again. And I felt I was totally in the clear because he was going to look at a tape of the speech. 3 days later, he never called me back. This piece appeared essentially accusing me of being a racist, which was then picked up by a bunch of other papers. And it was horrifying. It was absolutely horrifying. And it did shut me up for a while. Until I was talking to my editor at City Journal about it, and he suggested I write about it. And so I then called this reporter, who was startled to hear from me. This was a month or two after the original episode. And I said, I'm still waiting for you to call me back. You haven't called me. And he started stammering and said, well, you have to speak to my editor. He was frightened because people in the press, in the mainstream press, do this kind of thing with absolute impunity. And the idea that someone else was actually going to write about him and what he had done was horrifying to him.
You did then also deal with his editor, as I remember it.
I did. The editor was one of these.
She was intransigent.
She was an intransigent, unpleasant woman.
Yeah.
So I wrote the piece, and it was very gratifying. A lot of people canceled subscriptions. They got a lot of mail from people who, and for once they were hearing the other side.
That is recounted in a very compelling chapter in the new book. We now pause for another quick round of commercials, and then directly to the phones. If you're trying to call us at 312-591-7200, you're not getting through at the moment. You're hitting the busy signal. But remain persistent, and if you want to try again, do by all means right after we say goodnight to a prior caller. Also available, of course, is the email, extension 720 at tribune.com, and on to our listeners directly after this. We've had a rather solemn conversation so far. That is to say, we haven't focused so much on the funny stuff in here, but there's a lot of funny stuff in the new book by Harry Stein. I can't believe I'm sitting next to a Republican. And whether funny or solemn, we'll now go to the phones. 591-7200, the number. And first caller up, James in Waukegan. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. How are you?
Fine, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you for having me on. I certainly wanted to thank you, guests, for the conversation tonight. I wanted to start my comments by saying that I spent 20 years in the military, just retiring now after a rather long period of service. And I think I wanted to point out the fact that your guest, to some degree, answers his own question when the question's brought up, why is political discourse so acrimonious? Why are we having so many difficulties? But a few minutes later, your guest makes the comments that people who pose or people who come from the left and their ideology are uniformly unpatriotic, or perhaps that academia is pervasively ruled by the left and that the media is biased. I mean, certainly as someone who served in the military for so long and considers himself an unabashed liberal, I disagree with the notion that we are uniformly unpatriotic and that we are simply finding fault with the United States, you know, with our own country. And also to the degree that a standard English class or an English department is full of this, you know, of full of this direction where we're going to teach minority literature or feminists of today literature and ignore the classics is just, again, I believe it's a false notion. And this is the reason why we have such contentious rhetoric, is because, quite simply, you know, to paint the left with such broad brushes and to sound the same criticisms over and over again led us to this point, to where the American people vastly rejected the ideas of the right and that we needed to find a new direction forward.
Well, I think you're mischaracterizing what I said about the patriotism of the left. I said they define criticism of the country as patriotic, which is something we've heard over and over and over again. I didn't say that the left was by definition unpatriotic. In terms of the university system, I think you're simply wrong. I think the universities are hard left. And I think anyone who's looked carefully at this subject objectively will agree.
And I would add, because if you're a regular listener to this program, you know about my obsession with the lowering of higher education. I would add that simply the curriculum has been so weakened, and there's so much extraneous sort of quasi-political stuff pushed into it instead, that kids don't get as good an education as, say, their parents, surely their grandparents got if the grandparents went to college. And much of that education has to be done postgraduate. I don't mean in graduate school, but rather if they're hired by corporations because they're intrinsically bright, they then are put into sometimes remedial education for a year or two before they're really given any actual work within the corporation.
Yeah, I mean, what I was talking about in the book, in terms of individuals who are conservative who are trying to get jobs at universities, is I think undeniable. I mean, these people's experience over and over and over again is they simply cannot get hired.
Our thanks to the caller, and here's an email which is about as hostile as any of the ones I've seen so far, though it's just a one-liner. He says, "This is the most unintentionally hilarious radio show that I've ever heard, a masterclass in hypocrisy. You are a hilarious hypocrite.
Any way we can get a laugh, we'll take it.
I guess so. 591-7200 as we go now to Kevin in Waukegan. Good evening.
Thank you, Dr. Rosenberg, for having me on. And Mr. Stein, thank you for your book. I couldn't agree more, having been a student and served in two different university settings, that the literature department, among many, has gone very, very hard left. I wondered if you could give us any signs of hope for the future. Have you seen, growth in the hiring at any levels, any universities of conservative professors, or have you seen universities make some changes? Or in your mind, is it just kind of a continued slippery slope?
Actually, in literature, it isn't just a search for conservative professors. I think it's a search for professorial professors.
Yeah, well, there is an effort, which has started at Princeton, actually, kind of universities within, or small universities within universities.
That's Robbie George's program.
That's right. Robert George pioneered this, and it's now been taken up at a number of other places. I know Dartmouth, the University of Texas. These are generally independently funded by alumni, in which these are classically liberal enterprises. You know, they don't preach conservatism, but they try to tell both sides of the story, and so that movement is underway. It must be said, one of the cases I look at is Hamilton College, where a very brave conservative professor, the only self-identified conservative on that campus, tried to engineer such an operation there, had independent funding from alumni, and it was quashed by the administration and the rest of the faculty. So it is an upward battle. It's very tough, but there are some signs of hope.
So outside of private funding, there really just hasn't been any movement at this point in a positive direction. Is that an accurate kind of summation?
I think so, yes. I'm afraid so.
Okay.
We thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. I've just got an email here that I haven't even fully read. It's rather on the longish side, but all the same, I do want to read it to you and to our listeners. This is somebody in California. Last November, my wife and I leased a house in Half Moon Bay, south of San Francisco. Everyone we met was friendly, wanted to talk and boast about the beauty of their state and town. And when they found out that we were from Illinois, they gushed about how wonderful it must be to come from the same state as Barack Obama, sort of like being a devout Roman Catholic and meeting someone who had met the Pope. My wife is fearless when it comes to politics, and she initially addressed these statements by ardently correcting the liberal who put their foot in that bear trap. After a couple of instances where locals grimaced, fell back, and politely excused themselves from us, I convinced my wife to take, for my sake, a more neutral stance. When we were visiting Napa Valley, our tour guide discovered that we were from Illinois and said it must be wonderful, yada, yada, yada. He told us about a man who had put a McCain sign in his yard. The man's neighbor asked him to take it down because passers-by were not coming into the neighbor's business since they thought that the sign belonged to him. While our guide told this story, my wife pinched my leg hard but kept her mouth shut. When he asked us what we thought of the future, I said that Barack had been a senator from our state. He had accomplished little, so we were not necessarily enthused about him as president, but we would be willing to take a wait-and-see attitude. Our guide thought that was well put and considered us insightful people, despite our politics. Conclusion. Though hardcore leftists seem to be strident and often vituperative, as do hardcore conservatives, I found that in California, the mecca for all things liberal, the people were kind, polite, patient, and willing to hear us out. Excuse the cough. And willing to hear us out as long as we were nice about it. The entire state had drunk the Kool-Aid, but it didn't make anyone we met an absolute jerk.
Well, that's a very nice email. Actually, it's now that we're putting up this website, bluestateresistance.com, I'd love to see it on there.
I'll give you a copy of it.
That's well, sure. if the person feels comfortable.
Well, we should ask his,
yeah.
Ask him first, yes. We are about to pause for the usual reasons, and then back to the to the phones and to the email. 591-7200. I see one line available at the moment. And directly back to the phones for your questions and comments. And we go directly to Mike, who is on the road. Where are you on the road?
Well, I'm Interstate 80 westbound and ready to park my rig and go on vacation in about 2 hours.
All right. Go ahead, sir, please.
I heard someone said back a few years ago that they said, you know, liberalism can be defined as one with nothing but emotions and feelings with very little substance. And, you know, it just seems to me that, and I told my wife years ago, you know, as you see the country and the way the education is going, and that when you go to talk with most people, especially when it has to do with history or politics, there's just very little substance, and so many people are just basing things on what they think and what they feel. And unfortunately, I really believe that in the end, liberalism is going to trump out, because I think conservatism is a dying breed. And that's my comment.
Well, I mean, a lot of people agree with you right now. Conservatism is certainly on the ropes. I mean, liberalism has a very attractive and charismatic spokesperson, and conservatism has no one comparable. On the other hand, these kinds of predictions have been made before. I remember after the 64 election, when Goldwater was so trounced, a lot of people were proclaiming the death of conservatism. I think there are so many people in this country, and it is largely still a very conservative country. There was just a Quinnipiac poll where more people self-identify as conservative than liberal. So I think we have reason to hope that's not the case.
Here is an interesting email, which relates to my own university. In a recent address to a women's group from the University of Chicago, Hannah Holborn Gray, former president of the university, discussed the 18th century Enlightenment, which is her area of expertise. In an aside, she mentioned that the history department of the University of Chicago, where she now teaches, covers only very early and very recent history. She supposed she was accepted, she said with a shrug, since they continue to employ her. I think Dr. Gray's comment reflects, if not an anti-Western bias in a major university, at least a failure to address the ideas which formed the basis of the American Revolution and the American Republic. That's from Judy in Tinley Park.
That's a very wise comment. I absolutely agree.
It's an interesting comment from Hannah Gray. You know, her father, Hajo Holborn, was one of the leading historians of modern Germany. In fact, I knew him when he was a very senior figure at Yale, and I was a very junior figure as an early assistant professor. But we overlapped each other in a large lecture hall, his lecture coming directly before mine on at least two afternoons a week. So I got to know him on that basis, and much later met his daughter, who thereafter became president of the University of Chicago. 591-7200, and we go to Edward here in Chicago. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg and Mr. Stein. I was just going to say, I think your last caller basically summarized my point of view, that liberalism is going to win out because liberalism cares about all the people. Conservatism only cares about the rich and the powerful. And whenever you have hard times in this country, the conservative point of view doesn't solve the problems. Okay, telling people about the great entrepreneurial spirit when they don't have a job doesn't put a chicken in their pot. And that's the problem. When times are good, it's all right to be a conservative. When times are bad, you have to be a liberal to survive, because that's your only hope. And I also think about this, you know, hating America. Both sides accuse the other side of this. I think it's because we have a different definition of America, okay? The conservatives see America as the land of opportunity, like we were back in the 18th century. You know, just go out there and throw a stake in the ground and say all the land within a five-mile radius is yours. Democrats are realistic enough to know that it just doesn't work like that anymore. If you don't have a job, you better be able to collect unemployment or welfare or be on Social Security, or you won't be able to pay the rent. You know, this Republican fantasy, this myth that everybody can make it on their own, isn't solving America's problems. That's my point of view.
We've heard your point of view and well expressed. Let's get a response.
Well, I mean, look, we can argue political philosophy all day long. I mean, I'm keenly aware and I grew up as a liberal, with the of the notion that liberals profess to care a great deal more about ordinary people. There's no question. They make
that's
that
why
case.
I'm a Democrat.
Yes, they profess to, but if you're seriously interested in results, you have to look about who is going to build a working economy which actually puts people to work without rising inflation. I mean, you know, we're in a period right now where the economy is going to undergo stresses that we've never seen in American history.
May I remind you what Franklin Roosevelt said about American businessmen? He once said, "I cannot depend upon the patriotism of American businessmen to hire their fellow unemployed Americans."
Well, I mean, Roosevelt was a terrific Democrat and a great spinmeister. But, you know, the Depression continued until World War II, although it was effectively blamed on Hoover, and Hoover certainly had a role, or the Republicans in the early part of the Depression. Roosevelt continued. His policies did not end the Depression.
Our thanks to the caller. I fear we must be cruel to be kind. So many are waiting to talk that we'll go quickly to the next. And that one is Jack, also here in Chicago. Good evening, sir.
Yes. My question is, in the early days, I'm 70 years old, and when I was in college and, you know, a youthful person, liberals, the state of Israel was identified with the liberal cause. And it seems to me, or well, I shouldn't say it seems to me, I'll ask you, is it a coincidence that since Israel is now identified more with the neocons or the conservatives, that a lot of people of the Jewish faith have suddenly become conservatives? Are they identifying with Israel? And I'm not trying to say this in a prejudicial way at all, but it just seems to me that it's a coincidence that many people have suddenly transferred from liberalism to conservatism at the same time that Israel is now more identified with the conservative party in the United States.
Sir, I hate to intrude mere facts into your generalization, but the fact is that no single definable group in America voted more fully or more disproportionately for Barack Obama in the last election than did American Jews.
Well, Milton,
they are decidedly on the Democratic side of the ledger.
When did you change?
What?
When did you change?
Quite a while ago, as we've been talking about these things.
And did the state of Israel have anything to do with it?
I'm not aware at all aware that it did.
It didn't in my case either. As a matter of fact, I have a Jewish friend, a liberal friend in the town where I live, who's much less a friend now because he kind of derided Israel as a Nazi state to me. He said, it's another little corrupt Nazi state. And I was quite appalled to hear him say it. But, you know, I know a lot of people, Jews on the left, who are violently anti-Israel and are quite proud of the fact.
As a matter of fact, they bombard us all the time. I get email from a group recently organized or reorganized. What do they call themselves? Brit V'Shalom or something like that, who are peaceniks, want a two-state solution and want all settlements to be withdrawn from the West Bank, and urging that position upon the President of the United States to urge it upon the government of Israel. And there's a vast amount of that. There's a vast amount of that sort of sentiment within Israel itself, as you well know.
Absolutely. I think a lot of liberal Jews feel especially moral condemning Israel.
Yes, there's something perverse about that, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Much more could be said, but we discuss that rather often on this program, but that would be a temptation to go into that in great detail. We go directly to another caller, namely Greg in Indianapolis. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I have enjoyed your show. I'm kind of referencing the part where the Republican precinct worker invited his gal over, had a picture of George Bush.
Yeah.
That was great. But the comment after that was how Republicans are perceived as intolerant and mean, and they take care of the rich. Well, a honest, honorable Republican gets a soundbite on TV. He might be invited on a Sunday show for 15 minutes or half an hour. But the fact of the matter is, impressions of the Republican Party are, in my mind, is set by the conservative syndicated talk radio shows across the country, where they get 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, to rant and spew venom, and even Sean Hannity. He'll occasionally invite a political friend on his show, and his political friend will be calling him out, calling him for spinning, or did he hear that speech, or this, that, and the other. So with no one carrying the ball for the National Republican Party, basically, it's all on the conservative talk radio host, in my mind. Do you have a comment?
I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. You know, that certainly is how conservatives are characterized in the public mind. It must be said, I think Rush Limbaugh is by and large, I don't think he rants and spews. I think he's pretty reasonable. I think we have to make distinctions among these people. I would also say that as opposed to MSNBC, on Fox, they tend to have an alternative point of view. Now, Fox is clearly a conservative network, but they will always have on opposition figures. In terms of Republicans being mean-spirited and nasty, I mean, what you never hear, for example, is that conservatives give much more in terms of charitable giving than liberals do. You know, there's all kinds of misinformation. I think conservatives tend to be dealt with in the crudest of caricatures, and it's quite unfortunate.
We will thank the caller. Yes, sir. If you have another comment, please go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine, because we won't settle this over the course of this radio show.
I fear not. But it is an exchange of views, and that is always to be welcomed. 591-7200. We go to Fred in Merrillville. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. A great program, as usual.
Thank you, sir.
I'm 47, and I'm a conservative. I'm also a current college student here in Northwest Indiana, in the elementary education department. When you guys were talking about the liberalization of educational curriculum, especially at the college level, I can attest to that firsthand with all the indoctrination into liberal ideals and stuff that they give you in the education classes that you're taking. And even in a philosophy class that I took, in which the professor for the first 20 minutes of every class would bring out the New York Times and spend 20 minutes with a diatribe about bashing Bush and the Iraq War, and even encouraging some of the students to go to the anti-war rallies that were going on in Chicago at the time. And most of the kids would just sit there and because they didn't, at least he wasn't talking about the coursework or the stuff that they hadn't read for that day's lesson, so they figured there was less time to get to that stuff. But I had sat and listened to it for a couple of weeks, and finally I just had enough, because he started on how Bush was scheming to go into Iran next, and I just said, Ahmadinejad is one who denies the existence of the Holocaust, wanted to have Israel pushed off the face of the map into the ocean, and wants to get nuclear weapons, and yet you have a problem with what we're trying to do in the Middle East, and he got quite offended by that, and one else would even speak up in the class because they were afraid of reprisal, but I wasn't going to take it anymore.
Were there reprisals?
No, he didn't. And as a matter of fact, I have to admit, the next day I was in the lunchroom having lunch, and he asked if he could sit down, and he said he apologized if he had offended me. But the one thing I did tell him was that I was spending, $300 a credit hour to learn about philosophy and not about your political agenda. And, I didn't think that was the time and place for him to view that stuff. If he wanted to have an outside, group or something like that to air his views, I thought that was a more appropriate play.
Well, good for you for speaking up, because, as you say, most people don't. You know, I mean, there's one, maybe the worst of all subject areas is social work, actually. There was, I have in the book, I'm just looking at it now, It's in the code of ethics of the Council of Social Work Education, which is the accreditor of schools of social work, and it says that, in quotes, social work education programs must integrate social and economic justice content grounded in understanding of distributive justice, human and civil rights, and the global interconnections of oppression. So it is literally impossible to be accredited as a social worker unless you embrace a left-of-center worldview.
The same things that happen in certain schools of education.
Yes, absolutely.
At Teachers College in Columbia, the dispositions approach requires that you prove that you've got a left liberal slant on all those things, or they won't certify you as a teacher.
Exactly.
Sir, we have to move on, I fear. Thank you very much for your contribution. Let's go quickly to another. 591-7200 as we go to Lee in Milwaukee. Good evening.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on this. I always hear that remark about how conservatives give so much to charity, which maybe is true, but they're the ones with the money, in my opinion. And you do see the liberals or progressives doing all the grunt work, the mopping floors, washing dishes, serving the meals. They're not the ones with the money to give, you know, all these charities, and they go out and do the actual work.
So it's conservatives like George Soros and some of those Hollywood billionaires that you've got in mind, is it?
No, you know what I'm talking about, I think.
No, we really don't. I mean, this is again,
well,
a cliche.
I mean, but no, because I do this stuff, and I see who's doing the work.
I'm sure that
and Soros is giving to the political realm. He's not giving to the charities that I know of.
I'm talking about ordinary people across this country by the tens and hundreds of thousands.
Yes, giving the money because they've got the
ma'am,
money.
Ma'am, listen just a moment now, please. We've heard you. Hear a response.
These are middle class people by and large. These are church going people who are the most generous people in this country. And it's simply a fact. I mean, you can get exasperated and argue about it, but
they
it's simply
a fact.
They
are the church going people, but I am so sick of hearing about church going. I'm sick of hearing about Reagan and that party. Can't they move on from that? What is that about? I don't
listen,
get that either.
The fact is, there are a great many liberals who are. The general philosophy is that government will take care of people. People themselves do not have to be.
This has nothing to do with charities. You're changing the subject.
No, it has everything to do with charities. Charitable giving.
Ma'am, your exasperation may overwhelm you. I think she just hung up on us as well, as a matter of fact.
Okay. The point I was trying to make is that a lot of social liberals believe that is the function of government, essentially, to take care of us. Conservatives tend to feel that we have to look out for one another.
Well, I think that's perfectly clearly said, and not with much obfuscation or much ambiguity by the Democrats now in power.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The redistributional orientation is considered by them to be a legitimate approach to remaking America.
Yes, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. 591-7200, and let's see, we'll work in one more quick call at least. And here it is from Ben in Oak Park. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. As you guys were talking about conservatism and liberalism in education, and particularly higher education, I always go back and forth with my dad about this. As we talk, what I want to do is pose a question to you all and just asking, why is it that you believe that, regardless of my own political views or whatever, that liberalism has such a hold in higher education? And the only thing that I've been able to come up with, and I obviously know it's not rock solid by any means, is that as more information and ideas come and your world becomes more complex, you sort of begin to see that issues are bigger than you previously thought, and that sort of by nature ends up sort of bringing you to more a liberal point of view. But I sort of wanted to get your thoughts on what why liberalism does have such a strong hold in higher education.
I think it's very much a legacy of the 60s. When I was going to college, there was a much greater balance. There were certainly a great many liberal professors and a great many conservative professors. Liberalism kind of took over the universities in the 60s. They kind of caved in to a lot of the anti-war sentiment. And a lot of people who were radicals at the time when I was a kid went into that area. They stayed in education, they stayed at the universities, and they dominate the education system now.
Our thanks to that caller. We've had quite a range of callers tonight, and I think, though I haven't kept a tally, the balance has been more critical than supportive.
I welcome that. That's fine, as long as it's civil.
But everyone's been well-behaved, I think.
No name-calling, which is great.
Yeah. Though the lady in Milwaukee did convey a certain amount of exasperation.
Yes, I think if we'd kept her on, we would have been called fascists by now.
What are your own hopes for or expectations about the future in terms of political process and where it's taking us in this country?
Well, I try to be optimistic. I think it's a very delicate and dangerous time, both for the country in terms of its economic future, and frankly, I'm concerned about a lot of the elements who support Obama. When we talk about Acorn, I think these people are basically thugs, and I think they've been empowered to a remarkable degree, and I find it very worrisome.
I wish there were another hour that we could discuss some of that, but we cannot do so. Time left only to tell you that the book that we've been drawing from by Harry Stein is titled I Can't Believe I'm Sitting Next to a Republican. And I should tell you something about what's coming. Tomorrow night, we are talking with three people from the Heartland Institute here in Chicago about the global warming issue and about the cap and trade legislation, which is related thereunto. I think we'll have an interesting examination of some of the possibly obscured facts which need to be rendered less ambiguous and more visible. That's tomorrow at 9. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.